is Thursday, June 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Turkish politicians struggle to form a coalition government. Where are the two New York prisoners who escaped last week? How are U.S. officials responding to the recent cyber attack of government personnel records? A British actor famed for playing Count Dracula dies in London. And country music stars Tim McGraw and Brantley Gilbert want to say a big thank you to American veterans. It's all ahead. We start out the show with Turkish politics. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan made his first television appearance since the country's parliamentary election on Sunday. And VOA's Victoria Maki is covering the story. Victoria, welcome. How is the effort going in Turkey to form a coalition government?
So far, not very well. You know, you've got four parties. None of them have a majority in parliament right now after the elections earlier this week. And there aren't a lot of natural allies. So you've got party leaders saying who they don't want to form coalitions with, but you don't really have anybody coming out yet and saying who they do want to, you know, participate in a government with for the next few years.
And this was an election that President Erdogan, needless to say, was not very happy with the result.
Right. I think he had very different ideas and aspirations for his party and for his tenure. He really wanted to exert a fair amount more of executive power. And without getting a majority, he really doesn't have that ability anymore. And he's going to have to compromise along with the AKP party to form a government.
Now, what has he said in regard to the situation both involving Syria as well as the dangers faced by the Islamic State?
So this is something where foreign policy didn't play a huge role in the campaign in Turkey. And now there have been some jabs kind of traded, veiled jabs traded this week between Washington and Ankara, who have been in disagreement over quite some time about how to handle Islamic State. It doesn't seem like Mr. Erdogan is really loosening up at all. And the big question is, especially with the experts I've talked to, you know, how will a coalition handle this? And until they've figured out what the coalition is going to be, they really don't know yet. You know, Islamic State is so close, just kilometers from the Turkish border in the south in Syria. And yet there isn't a strategy among the parties for how to handle it.
And of course, I believe in the country is still dealing with, there's a very difficult situation involving Syrian refugees near the border there in Turkey.
Thousands still continue, you know, somewhere between 1.5 and 2 million total. And people keep coming across the border. And Turkey's saying, listen, your U.S. coalition, your airstrikes are not successful. You're just sending more people across the border into Turkey. So we need a better solution.
All right. Well, that's my thanks to Victoria Maki. Now I'm joined by Michael Lippin, who's looking at various social media. And there's a rather sad story today, Michael. But on the other hand, there's a lot of very positive comment about this person.
Hi, Sarah. Yes, that's true. It is a sad story, and it's about the death of British actor Christopher Lee. But there is a lot of positivity coming out of that, and I'll explain why in just a moment. Christopher Lee's death is actually the number one trending topic on Twitter, not just here in the U.S., but worldwide. He died on Sunday at the age of 93, but his passing from natural causes was only disclosed today. Now, Lee came to prominence early in his career with villainous roles like Dracula and Frankenstein in the 1950s, and he earned a new generation of fans much later by starring as a leading villain in the Star Wars prequels and the Lord of the Rings trilogy in the first half of the 2000s. Now, that perhaps explains why so many people have been tweeting tributes to him today. In fact, analytics website Topsy shows that he's been mentioned at least 369,000 times on Twitter in the past day. That's about four tweets per second.
Well, so what kinds of tributes have been people leaving for him?
Well, I've had a look at some of the tributes coming in from the worlds of politics and entertainment. British Prime Minister David Cameron tweeted this message from his @number10gov account. Saddened to hear of Sir Christopher Lee's death, a titan of the golden age of cinema and distinguished World War II veteran who will be greatly missed. The mayor of London, Boris Johnson, also had this to say: "Really sad to hear about the death of Christopher Lee, one of the greatest British actors and a master of the macabre." Lee's Lord of the Rings co-star Elijah Wood remembered him this way on Twitter: "An extraordinary man and life led, Sir Christopher Lee. You were an icon and a towering human being with stories for days. We'll miss you." Lee literally was a towering figure. He was 6'5" tall. That's 194 centimeters. And one more tweet here from Dominic Monaghan, another co-star from Lord of the Rings: "So sorry to hear that Christopher Lee has passed away. He was a fascinating person. Threw a Bic pen into a tree in front of me. Hashtag legend." Well, Sarah, do you have a favorite Christopher Lee movie?
I think I'd have to say it would have been a Dracula movie, one of his Dracula roles. I liked him in
that. So one of the early ones.
Yeah, but you know, also I was looking on the web today. He would sing, and he sang over a heavy metal soundtrack, so sort of a Christmas album.
I never knew that until when we saw the reports today, looking back at his life. So, yeah.
All right. Well, that's Michael Lippin telling us the latest about telling us the latest in social media.
Thanks, Sarah.
All right. Thanks very much. Thanks very much. All right. We are now joined by VOA's cyber correspondent, Doug Bernard. Last week, U.S. officials announced a huge data breach of personnel records contained at the Office of Personnel Management. And Doug Bernard has been looking into the opinions of analysts reviewing this case. So, Doug, is it known how extensive was this hack?
You know, I suppose we're moving from fake scary now to real scary, at least in the cyber world. How large was the attack? Well, we know that the records of 4 million current and former federal employees have been taken. Now, these aren't just perhaps name, address, social security number, that basic kind of stuff. These are the personnel files, the very private personnel files. We've talked before just about how extensive, as federal employees, we've filled these forms out. So, you know, we have a real deep sense as to how much is there. There's genuine concern and growing concern now because, you know, think about, for example, all the various people who are working with the United States government who have been involved in issues in Beijing or in China or working with people there. You know, a lot of this information it now might have leaked out. And it's really creating, I think, genuine concern and growing concern that the United States government was really caught, you know, with its cyber pants down in this case.
Yeah. Some officials have blamed this attack on saying it came from China, whether it was
right.
The actual government or, you know, companies or people in China. But the Chinese have denied this. What is continuing about that?
Well, as they have in the past, Chinese officials, whenever a big hack like this happens and fingers point back to China, Chinese officials always say, there's no proof, this is irresponsible, we're not behind this. And the U.S. government, still up to this point, has been careful. They're not pointing the finger at the government of China, but they're saying it looks like these attacks originated from within China. You have to suspect that investigators probably know a little bit more than they're releasing. It's like a police investigation. You don't come forward with everything that you know while the investigation is going on. You used the word attack, and I think that's a very interesting and relevant one, because part of the discussion that's happening now is what exactly was this? So, for example, Ian Bremmer, who is the president of the Eurasia Group, it's a risk management and strategy organization, very well known in the United States. He's unequivocal. He's come out and he said, let's be clear, we are at virtual war with China, or actually, in his calculation, China is at virtual war with us. Other people that I've spoken with, for example...
That's pretty strong language.
That is very strong language.
Yeah.
Other people I've spoken with, for example, Kobe Friedman, who is the founder and CEO of a web security group, Chameleon. He said, well, no, this is not war. Let's pull back on the rhetoric. This clearly looks like espionage. So for the last several days, I've been speaking with a variety of people about the difference, the legal international difference between declaring something an act of war and declaring something an act of espionage. And this is much more than just a semantic difference.
And how do you do that? I mean, how can you say, is it something espionage or it's actually war?
Well, you know, over... really a period of hundreds of years, there's been a body of law that's built up called jus in bello among attorneys. That's just Latin for the law of war. And what's happening now are military strategists, legal scholars are now trying to adapt that established law of war and move it into the cyber realm. The law of war is very clear. There are, you know, in terms of defining what war is, when it's a just war, how you can justly begin it and justly end it, how you treat prisoners, how you define a combatant versus a civilian, all that kind of stuff. None of that exists in cyber. And I think there's another, so people are kind of trying, I think the difference of opinion, is this an act of war, is this an act of espionage? The difference of opinion is that, well, we just really don't know yet because the law has not caught up with technology.
All right. Well, thanks very much. That's Doug Bernard. And remember, you can read his web piece on voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
This is the sound of a coronal mass ejection, a CME, exploding from the sun. CMEs are bubbles of superheated gas and highly charged particles that blast from the sun. Occasionally, when Earth is in the line of fire of a CME, technologies we take for granted, such as GPS, satellite, and radio communication, can be interrupted. They can also take down power grids. Current detection technology can provide only a 30 to 60 minute warning of an impending solar storm. But scientists in the UK have come up with a new tool that could provide more than 24 hours notice before CME particles hit the Earth. Getting a warning a day earlier could help technicians protect sensitive electronics against a solar storm. Fortunately, those of us living on Earth are pretty much protected from most of these harmful solar particles by our atmosphere and magnetic field. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, country music stars rallied to the cause of American veterans. Here in the United States, the search continues for two convicted killers who escaped from a maximum security prison in upstate New York last week. I'm joined now by VOA's New York correspondent, Adam Phillips. Adam, officials seem to think the prisoners may be in Vermont. Why is that?
Well, that's what they thought a few hours ago. These things sort of changed by the minute. They thought that they might go to Vermont because it's nearby, it's rural, it's not New York State where they're the manhunt is most intense, but and also there are places, there are lots of remote rural campsites where they could hole up. Speaking of which, they have a new lead now where some dogs, you know, these sniffer dogs, have found a place where apparently these guys bedded down in New York State to spend the night or at least to get out of the weather. So there is a scent that's been picked up, and people are very hopeful that that really means that they're closing in on these horrible people.
Well, now, where is that area, the area where the search is taking place?
Well, it's taking place all over, obviously, upstate New York, which is right near the Canadian border. But this latest lead happened, occurred, this bedding was discovered right outside Plattsburgh, New York. So it's not that far away, but it's a good lead. But it's a very, very wide dragnet.
How much is known yet about how these two men were able to escape?
Well, they know what they actually did. They don't know how they were able to do what they did. They were able to somehow use power tools to cut a big hole in the steel wall of their jail cell to go out onto the catwalks and all this sort of, you know, infrastructural apparatus outside the cells between the cell blocks, break through a brick wall, cut through a steam pipe 24 inches, about maybe two-thirds of a meter wide, and then crawl out beyond the perimeter and emerge through a manhole.
Is it known whether they received any help, particularly from someone, an employee at the prison?
It's very strongly suspected that they got some help, or at least some kind of aid, even if it just was information from a Joyce Mitchell, who was the one who sort of suspected of helping them. She was a local who worked in the prison tailor shop and may have been responsible for passing them tools. Some people say they may have gotten the tools from contractors who don't have the same security clearance that prison officials do. They may have just left tools around. apparently Joyce Mitchell, this is all supposition now, none of it has been confirmed,
right?
She was supposed to meet them at the manhole where they escaped from, but she got cold feet, had a panic attack, and went to a nearby hospital. But some newspapers are saying that the authorities have enough information from the statement she's made to indict her.
How dangerous are these two men?
Extremely dangerous. For one thing, they've got nothing to lose. They're both in prison basically for the rest of their lives. One of these guys, Richard Matz, 48 years old, is serving 6 years to life with an accomplice, kidnapping his boss, murdering him brutally, and then dismembering him and throwing his body in the river. Then his accomplice was also horrible. He killed a sheriff's deputy who had discovered him and an accomplice moving guns from one car to another. So not only are they convicted murderers and of the worst horrible kind, but they also have nothing to lose. If they get caught, what are they going to do? Just go back to maximum prison again. So they could do anything to stay free.
All right. Well, my thanks to Adam Phillips in New York. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Sometimes military veterans believe they don't always get the respect they deserve. VOA's David Byrd and Nikki Strong join us now to tell us about two country music stars who want to change that.
Many times, if you see an American veteran in the airport or at the bus station or even on the street, people will come up and thank them for their service. Well, a couple of country music stars have come up with a very unique way to thank veterans. One of them's Brantley Gilbert. The other one's Tim McGraw. VOA Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong joins me in the studio. Nikki, what are these country stars doing for veterans? What is it? What's going on here?
Oh, I think it's awesome. First of all, Tim McGraw. He has teamed up with Chase and Operation Homefront, an organization that assists veterans, to give away newly renovated mortgage-free homes to military families, which I think is awesome. He's been giving them away for about 3 years now. So he's given away about 108 homes. He's on tour right now, and he shares that with his audience. And it's been a wonderful, I think it's a wonderful gesture. And he has shared even with the press. He says, you know, the return to civilian life can be a challenging transition. And he says, you know, we want to welcome veterans back home to the community they sacrificed to protect. And a mortgage-free home provides stability for their families and allows them to start this new chapter in their lives without one less worry or without one less worry.
Mm.
So it's, and he enjoys, he says, it's an amazing feeling to give them something that they deserve and to be able to share it with his fans across the country.
Speaking of giving people things, I understand Brantley Gilbert got a very special gift from a veteran recently at a concert.
Oh, man.
Why don't you tell the audience what exactly happened there?
This is very touching, and the video went viral. And so you had Wounded Warriors and Harley Davidson came together for a motorcycle ride called Project Odyssey, which was to raise awareness for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And they had a VIP guest, which was Brantley Gilbert. And one veteran, he was an Army vet, Staff Sergeant Justin Patterson, was so touched by Brantley Gilbert's contribution and his willingness to participate to raise awareness for PTSD and to give back to the veterans, that he gave Brantley Gilbert his personal Purple Heart.
And for the audience that doesn't know, the Purple Heart is a medal that a soldier receives for being wounded in action.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the conversation of him actually giving it to Brantley Gilbert is recorded, and it went viral. And so it hit the news circuits. And so Sergeant Justin Patterson was actually on TV. And in response, Brantley Gilbert then reached back out to him and gave him a couple of tickets to the CMT Music Awards.
Nice, nice. Well, we'd love to know what you think about these efforts to help veterans. Please let us know. You can post your comments on our Facebook page. That's VOA Music. It's facebook.com/VOA-music. Nikki, you also have a Twitter account people can tweet to you?
Yes, they can reach me on VOA's Twitter account.
That's at VOA Music.
Mm-hmm, at @VOA_music. And they can also hit me up at I Am Nikki Strong.
All right, that's VOA's Nikki Strong. Nikki, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm giving out 21 guns blazing. That's one.
And that's our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Stopping the recruitment of foreign terrorist fighters is a key concern for the global coalition to counter ISIL. General John Allen, the U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL, stressed this point in his speech to the Brookings Doha U.S. Islamic World Forum. He noted that comprehensive approaches to reduce the foreign terrorist fighter flow must start at the point of radicalization. Last year's United Nations Security Council Resolution 2178 calls on all nations to strengthen their borders, share information, and adjust their laws to criminalize traveling for terrorism. More than 30 partners have now made legal and justice reforms intended to make it more difficult to travel to the battlefront. Increasingly, as a result of the Internet, it is no longer necessary for foreign terrorist fighters to leave their home countries to be radicalized and recruited. This phenomenon has opened the door to radicalized individuals to conduct terrorist attacks in their home countries. Lone offender attackers, as they have become known, are a growing concern. That is why all nations need to work together at every link along the chain, at every border between a potential foreign terrorist fighter and the battle space, in their home communities, and at the point of recruitment and radicalization. The coalition's Foreign Terrorist Fighter Working Group is organizing coalition action around 9 fronts, ranging from border control to information sharing to mapping travel to improving legal capabilities and post-counteroffensive foreign terrorist fighter flows. ISIL is practiced in exploiting a sense of rootlessness and separation that many young people feel in their communities, whether in minority communities in the West, in certain Arab societies, or in Southeast Asia. A feeling of disenfranchisement and otherness is present and powerful for many, said General Allen. There is also separation between the opportunities young people see on their smartphones and those they believe are available to them in their own lives. We must guard against the manipulation of these separations and anxieties, said General Allen, while at the same time working to address their root causes. Stopping the flow of foreign terrorist fighters is critical to winning the fight against ISIL. Through strength and unity of purpose, ISIL can and will be defeated.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Thank you.